Today, a 24-year fight against the oil giant Shell reaches court this week. And the consequences of Donald Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria. This is a story that starts in Ogoniland, a region in the southeast of Nigeria in the Niger Delta. For thousands of years, it has been home to the Ogoni people who farmed the land and fished in the creeks. And then in 1956, oil was discovered, bringing large multinational companies keen to extract this valuable resource. But this extraction was at the expense of the region and the people living there.
They are just like cancer. Shell is just like cancer. The world has to know what they did in Ogoniland. The mess they leave in Ogoniland.
In the early 90s, the Ogoni people began to fight back against Shell, the largest company operating in that region at the time. What followed was a violent and deadly outbreak alleged to have involved collusion between the Nigerian government and the oil firm, which led to the deaths of many, including the execution of 9 men. They became known as the Ogoni Nine. This week, after a 24-year fight, Shell's role is finally being examined by a court in The Hague. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, who killed the Ogoni Nine? If you were to describe what Ogoniland looks like to somebody who hasn't ever been there, what would you say?
Ogoniland was a peaceful place, not until when soldiers came in because of our God-given wealth, which is the oil, and came in, divided the people. So not until when they got there, we're going to turn to something else.
This is Esther Kiabel. She grew up in the Niger Delta and lived in the Ogoni region. The oil that was extracted during Esther's childhood quickly became a vital part of Nigeria's economy. By the mid-1990s, it made up over 95% of Nigeria's total exports. But with oil spills polluting the land and water, the Ogoni people began to organise in protest at Shell's work.
After decades of watching the Nigerian state and multinationals get richer and richer, and basically waterways being polluted, farmland being contaminated.
Kate Hadal is a Guardian reporter who has been covering this story.
Some activists got together in 1990, and a well-known writer and activist named Ken Saro-Wiwa formulated the movement for the survival of Ogoni people, which is also known as MUSAP.
We are going to demand our rights peacefully, non-violently, and we shall win.
And they were basically calling for cleanup, for environmental damages to be reversed, for greater riches and royalties to be brought to the Ogoni people.
I accuse the ethnic majority who run Nigeria of practicing genocide against the Ogoni people. I accuse the oil companies which prospect for oil in Ogoni of encouraging genocide against the Ogoni people.
Now in 1993, Ken Saro-Wiwa and MUSAP led a demonstration against Shell. Around 300,000 people came to this demonstration. They were demanding that Shell pay $10 billion in royalties, lost royalties, to the Ogoni people and in damages for environmental destruction. Now, I mean, $10 billion in the 1990s was a huge sum. Shell pulled out, basically citing security concerns.
Shell is declared persona non grata in Ogoni.
That basically started this David and Goliath fight between villagers and this multinational that we have seen continue on for decades until today.
And in 1993, there was a military coup in Nigeria. What did that mean for the oil companies and for the people living in Ogoniland?
I mean, to the best of my knowledge, the Nigerian government had already been responding to these protests with violence. But when the military government came in under Sani Abacha, things definitely took a worse turn.
This regime will be firm, humane, and decisive. We will not condone nor tolerate any act of indiscipline. Any attempt to test our will be decisively dealt with.
In October of 1993, Shell went back to visit its wells, which had been left sort of abandoned since the Mossad protests had started, and they were accompanied by the Nigerian military. Two protesters were killed in those clashes, but internal documents showed that Shell later paid the military unit who they were with as a show of gratitude and motivation. Activists have pointed to this as proof that Shell was essentially buying off the military support.
Things just got even worse. Four men were killed. What happened? Why was this a significant turning point in this story?
So four men who were Ogoni chiefs who were at the time opposed to Ken Zarawiwa and his movement for the survival of Ogoni people were killed in a mob clash. Pretty quickly, the Nigerian military blamed Ken Zarawiwa and the movement for the survival of Ogoni people.
I have directed all the villages there that took part must be rounded up. Most of leadership that was part of this game must be arrested. And the security forces are out doing just that.
But there was never really any evidence to suggest that Ken Zarawiwa or any of the other people who were implicated in it were directly involved.
So who were the men who were arrested?
Well, there were nine men. One of them was Ken Zarawiwa. Then there was Barnum Kiobel, who was a state minister at the time. And he had been previously critical of the government's position with the Ogoni people. And then there were seven other members of the movement for the survival of Ogoni people.
Esther Kiobel was married to Barnum Kiobel.
He was the man of the people. He's a man that would just sit down and laugh. You never upset him. He was my best friend.
What happened to him and the other eight men after they were arrested and held in prison?
They always refused them food, refused them seeing doctors, even when they are sick. They always tortured them, put chain on the leg.
They were jailed for almost a year before they were allowed to see their lawyers. A number of them indicated that they were being forced to sign false affidavits about their involvement in this mob killing. Some of the lawyers even indicated that they were also being beaten by the military. And then they were taken to trial, which was widely discredited as a sham trial. And in October of 1993, they were sentenced to be hanged. And 1 month later, they were hanged in secret, and then their bodies were dumped in unmarked graves.
In October 1995, your husband was sentenced to death and then killed. Can you tell me about the day you found out that he had died?
The day they passed the death sentence. When we get there, they said, some soldiers told us, they've taken them this way. And that road was leading to the prison yard. So when we got to the prison yard, there was some soldiers everywhere, surrounded everywhere. They signal us the way they signal it, which means they are already wasted. They've killed them. Immediately, I fell to unconscious. What came out of my mind before I fell was, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabatani. Which means, my God, why forsaking me?
So they took nine men who were innocent, many of whom had protested peacefully against the huge destruction that a private oil company had wrought on their homes and their land, and they were killed. It must have sent a very powerful message.
To the people of Ogoni?
Yeah.
Definitely. And after that, the Nigerian military went in, they burned and razed homes, they went on a killing and arresting and raping spree and sent that message that just don't mess with us.
That's absolutely horrific. What was the reaction to the killings both in Nigeria and around the world?
Nigeria was suspended from the Commonwealth as a result.
Mr. Major had believed diplomatic pressure could change Nigeria's mind. Now he too is unequivocal.
I said yesterday that I thought this was a fraudulent trial, a bad verdict, an unjust sentence, and it has now been followed by judicial murder.
I urge all of you here to keep the pressure on Shell to accept the responsibility for what has happened in Ogoni.
You know, the Abacha regime was widely condemned, but life continued on.
After the killings, what did the government claim had happened?
Well, I mean, the government response was that they had actually helped clean up Ogoni land and that they had saved lives.
Wow.
Something like 1,000 people were killed in Ogoni as a result of the clashes between the state and the military and the protesters. Much of that was, I would say, extrajudicial killings of people who were unarmed as the state sort of just did what it thought that it needed to do to take charge.
You see, the government of Nigeria is concerned about peace and stability in the country. Therefore, all the actions of the present government is aimed at maintaining peace and stability.
And then you had extrajudicial killings that also occurred after the trial, and a number of women and girls who were being raped in the villages and people who lost their homes. I think something like 30,000 people lost their homes as a result of these clashes.
It might have been that the hanging of these 9 men and the destruction that happened in the aftermath could have been the end of the Ogoni challenge to Shell. But this was just the beginning. Many families wanted answers about what had happened and wanted to clear their loved ones' names. One of them was Esther Kiabel. You had to flee Nigeria with 7 children, your own children and your sister-in-law's children, and you managed to claim asylum in America, Esther. What was that like?
Find me a new home to live, a new hope to live. Telling me I can be what I want to be in America, in which I did with my children, I would have been killed without coming to America.
Despite leaving her home to begin life in a new country, she continued her legal fight against Shell. In 2002, she brought a class action against them, but 11 years later, the Supreme Court ruled that it had been filed in the wrong jurisdiction. In 2009, however, the family of environmental activist Ken Saro-Wiwa did take the Orange Aunt to court in New York in a separate case. But on the eve of the trial, Shell instead agreed to pay $15.5 million in a settlement, one of the largest payouts agreed by a multinational corporation charged with human rights violations. Esther was not one of the claimants.
It was a huge sum of money. It was $15.5 million. And that settlement was paid out by Shell to the Ken Saro-Wiwa family, as well as some other claimants.
The case was due to go before a US court when Shell unexpectedly offered to settle.
And that covered their legal fees. Essentially, it was meant to cover some damages. And then around a third of it, so about $5 million, went to establishing an educational trust with the aim of benefiting the Ogoni people.
Although Shell paid out the money, this, of course, meant they avoided a trial, a public hearing.
Mm-hmm. And also, they were very clear in paying the money that they denied any responsibility or wrongdoing. So they paid money, but they also said we weren't involved.
In that lawsuit, what was Shell accused of having done?
The families alleged that Shell conspired with the military government to capture and hang the men, the Ogoni 9. And Shell was also accused of other alleged human rights violations, including working with the army to bring about killings and torture of Ogoni protesters.
Oh my God. So, I mean, this is huge. I mean, it obviously goes way beyond Shell just working with the government to just protect their facilities.
Yeah, no, in that lawsuit, the company was also alleged to have provided the Nigerian army with vehicles and patrol boats and ammunition, and to have also helped plan raids and terror campaigns against villagers in Ogoni land.
If Shell had hoped that this would close the Ogoni 9 case, they had underestimated the determination of Esther and three other Ogoni Nime widows, Victoria Bera, Blessing Iawo, and Charity Lavula. They kept on fighting for years, and then finally in May, they made a huge breakthrough when a Dutch court ruled that it had jurisdiction to determine whether Royal Dutch Shell was complicit in the Nigerian government's execution of the men.
Just worth adding that a court in the Netherlands is due to hear the first arguments later in an historic civil case brought by Nigerian Ogoni activists against the oil company based in The Hague, Royal Dutch Shell.
The firm is accused. Hi, it's Hannah.
Hi, Hannah. It's Rachel again. Thank you for bearing with me. Hannah Samkouden is the lead lawyer from human rights law firm Bracken de Oliveira. Today, witnesses from the original Ogoni Nine court case are giving evidence.
I knew we had to do it because the case deserves to be heard somewhere. And after we'd gotten the chance to look into it more thoroughly, yes, I did believe that the Dutch court would be in the right place to hear this case.
Why can this case be heard in the Netherlands?
Shell is a Dutch company. The fact that it has a seat in the Netherlands creates jurisdiction.
What will the court hear? What is really on trial here?
Well, the court has really narrowed the case to the sole issue of bribery. It has stated that there could be liability of Shell if it is proven that, as our witnesses have stated, they were bribed in the Ogoni trial to testify against the defendants, and that they were bribed by promises of money and jobs at the local government or Shell, and that Shell was involved in that bribery.
What do you hope the outcome of this case will be?
At this point, it would be good if the witness testimonies reveal the direct involvement of Shell. It would be good if the case brings justice to our plaintiffs. At the same time, we also felt it was our mission to show that if you act in such a way as Shell has in a country where there's a military regime like there was at the time in Nigeria, if you are so actively involved, so intertwined with the local authorities that there's no way that one can do something without the help of the other, that I think was something that we really wanted to make clear to the court. And you could say we've already failed in that because the court has already dismissed a large part of that argumentation.
Esther, what does it mean to you that your case is finally being heard this week?
From this case, I believe I'm going to get relief. Relief of what really happened. From the kangaroo court to what Shell did with Ogoni people, they have a question to answer. I need them to tell me why my husband was killed.
Yeah.
Because my husband's name is still in the book of criminal, and that's what I'm fighting for.
Esther doesn't want financial compensation. She just wants to exonerate her husband. Kate, what implications could this case have for Shell?
The implications for Shell, you know, could potentially be grave in that they have, I think, something like 50 pending court cases around the world regarding their operations with, you know, allegations of human rights abuses, environmental destruction, corruption. And I think for them, this court case could spell something quite ominous for them about how they operate.
And in Ogoni Land now, how much of a presence does Shell have there?
The most recent news is that the Nigerian government has just bought out Shell's share of an oil mining license in Ogoni, which is very interesting timing considering what's happening with this court case in the Netherlands. You know, Shell hasn't been operational in Ogoni since the 1990s, since this entire thing basically happened. And you would presume that Nigeria is looking to basically recoup some of its losses from not being able to produce in that hugely lucrative oil-producing region.
Even though Shell haven't been operating in the region for years, the environmental impact of oil extraction does still affect people living there to this day.
One of our reporters, Ruth McLean, she's based in West Africa, she went to the Niger Delta and spent some time with some of the women who are basically trawling through these oil-ridden mudflats looking for small bits of food to collect from the water, you know, small bits of crop to be able to pull up from the earth. And she said that it's just nothing but oil. It's just big, sticky, black oil mess. Why has there been no cleanup? Why are people not able to farm their land or to drink their water? Why are they suffering when there's so much money in the state itself?
Do you still have friends and relatives living in Ogoniland? What's it like there now?
It's still terrible, horrible. They're still there with pollution, killing people. Have lost a lot of family members. They lied. They said they clean up. They're not really cleaning up nowhere. Each minute, second, hours, the Ogoni people are dying in numbers because of pollution, because of poison water, poison food, poison plant, poison everything.
Esther, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you for having me.
Esther and the other Ogoni widows brought the case being heard this week in the Netherlands with the help and support of Amnesty International. Shell Nigeria have always denied in the strongest possible terms the allegations against them. They say they express shock and sadness at the time of the executions and have previously argued the evidence of the circumstances clearly shows that they are not responsible for the distressing events. They have maintained they did not collude with the military authorities to suppress community unrest and in no way encouraged or advocated any act of violence in Nigeria. You can follow this case and read more about the Ogoni Nine at theguardian.com. Coming up, Donald Trump's decision to withdraw American troops from Syria. Now, Turkey has signalled its intent to press ahead with an attack on US-backed Kurdish-led forces in northeast Syria after Donald Trump said he would take his troops out of the region. Turkey considers Kurdish militants to be an extension of the banned PKK, which has fought for Kurdish autonomy in the country for three decades. Guardian Defence editor Dan Saber, who recently returned from northern Syria, weighs up the implications of Trump's decision.
Donald Trump didn't look like he was going to do anything. There are 1,000 US troops going to the independence of northeast Syria. And then suddenly there was his late night phone call on Sunday. And at 11 o'clock, the White House puts out a statement, catches everyone by surprise. Trump wants all the US troops out of Syria. And then if the Turks want to invade, so be it. The Americans aren't going to get involved and they could take control of the ISIS prisoners too. And everyone was absolutely stunned that suddenly the guarantors of this fragile northeast Syria, the guys who had provided the ground forces and the struggle against ISIS, were losing their backers, the people who were keeping them independent and autonomous. Donald Trump could not find any friends to defend him, really, in Washington. People were arguing that the Kurds had, in effect, been sold down the river. About 12,000 soldiers died in the fight against ISIS. The fact they'd fought together suddenly meant nothing. Kurds were going to be at risk of being sort of taken over by a country that's been hostile to them for years and years and years. An extremely dangerous, terrifying situation for the Kurds on the ground and an extremely unexpected situation, even for those following the erratic twists and turns of Donald Trump. Faced with this sort of incessant criticism from foes and friend alike, Trump starts to do a bit of backtracking and he says he doesn't want the Turks to misbehave or invade and he threatens economic destruction of Turkey if they don't conduct themselves to his liking. Meanwhile, you know, the international community is getting more and more concerned about the situation. On Tuesday, Britain started to say it doesn't welcome the idea of a Turkish invasion and distances itself from the US position. The Kurds have been left dealing with the legacy of the Islamic State. They've been left with two things. They're holding at least 6,000, but probably twice as much as that in terms of the number of prisoners. So it's completely unclear whether they can maintain the security of these prisons, whether they'll want to try because they might have to be fighting the Turks, whether they'd let them go and say, do you want to fight the Turks and help us? That's happened before in Afrin. And then secondly, you've got the camps. There are hundreds of thousands of people in refugee camps, internally displaced persons. All they control at the moment, the SDF, the local military, all they control is the perimeter of the camps. They don't control inside the camps. These are mostly women and children. So the people running the camps are what are called radical women, some of the old ISIS morality police. And terrible stories of a woman killing her daughter. When I was out there, a woman killing her daughter with a hammer, leaving the body outside because she didn't wear the chador, the full veil. This is where the kind of last flickers of ISIS are, if you like, burning. And in a whole different situation where suddenly the SDF can't patrol them. What's going to happen to this population? So once you take all this together, this is a combustible and entirely unpredictable situation. This is an entirely personal decision by the president. He's been here before.
President Trump has ordered the Pentagon to pull all U.S. troops out of Syria. Earlier, he tweeted, quote, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria. My only reason for being there during the Trump presidency."
He was talked out of it. With this president, he's so erratic, he's so unpredictable, no one can be sure what will happen. And that's really worrying because the fate of 1.5 million Kurds in Syria is depending on these whims. And that's, when you think about it like that, it's quite terrifying, but this is the world that we live in now.
That was Dan Saber. Thanks to him, Kate Hadal, Esther Kiabel, and Hannah Samkalden. Today's programme was produced by Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you tomorrow.